The serfs who belonged to the manors never got rich. They were at the bottom of feudal society because they owned no land. Serfs were not even allowed to move away from a manor without the lord's permission, because his wealth depended on the labor they supplied. The lord rewarded his serfs for the service of their labor by giving them a place to live, a share of the crops they raised, and protection during dangerous times. In their manor villages, they were not even allowed to grind their own grain into flour for bread. Instead, they had to pay to have it ground at the lord's mill. In feudal society, even though serfs produced nearly all the food, did most of the hard labor, and were the largest class of people, they had few rights and almost no opportunity for education. As a result, it was nearly impossible for them to rise above the poverty that ruled their lives.
Children of the State, Part 3, Trapped. Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is December 28th, 2010. Today, I want to resume the Children of the State series, picking up right where we left off. The last installment was called The Treatment Trough, and I was a little concerned that I might have left things kind of vague when it came to the whole Medicaid and medicating children in poverty trick that has unfortunately become so common in the last couple decades. Now, whenever I talk to people about the philosophy of liberty, about voluntarism, about, God forbid, the eventual emergence of a stateless society, one of the questions that I'm often forced to answer is, what about the poor? Who will take care of the poor? It's a fair question. Unfortunately, it has the assumption built into it that the poor are being taken care of now. And it depends on what you mean by that. So today I want to take a little bit of a closer look using a story from Massachusetts to provide some detail on this poverty trap, welfare trap situation that so many less fortunate people face today. And most importantly, I want to answer the question, what is the price paid for the assistance that so many people in poverty are receiving from the government today? Because unfortunately, in many cases, it is the health and the well-being and the minds of the children of people in poverty. And even more unfortunately, the parents of these boys and girls are being incentivized to put their children in harm's way by the system. Now, before we get into all that, I have a story that I would like to share. I think some of you might find interesting. First of all, a little over a month ago, I decided to take a vacation from sharing my ideas and my philosophy and the application of that philosophy to current events with people who are not like-minded. I actually made this decision after being urged to do so by a friend who thought it would be a good opportunity for me to evaluate my motivation behind many of these discussions in the past, especially with family. Also during this time, I was able to learn quite a bit about a new strategy for communicating with other people, nonviolent communication. Of course, Wes Bertrand, Daniel Lockemacher, and I are currently doing a series on NVC on Complete Liberty Podcast. I think we actually the other day, I think we just recorded the fifth installment, and that should be out relatively soon. And NVC deals a lot with motivation. One of the main components of NVC is honest self-expression, which I think includes understanding your own intentions for communicating with people, even when that communication, when that discussion can be a little bit tense. And another aspect of NVC is, of course, compassion, empathetic listening, and understanding. So being very, very well rested and having some new ideas about how to connect with other people who
don't understand the philosophy of liberty. Christmas came. That's always a big family gathering with a lot of the folks that I've tried to discuss these things with in the past. And I figured I would give it a try since others wanted to discuss some issues and current events anyway. I thought I would participate. This was interesting. And the conversation was different than discussions that we had had in the past because I tried to make it very much about understanding other people's needs. And it actually was relatively peaceful and went on for quite some time and was even, dare I say, productive. But I still, as I left this family get-together and I got in my car and I was driving back from the seacoast of New Hampshire to Manchester where I live, I kept thinking as I was driving about the theory of evolution. And I started to picture this conversation in my head. And it could have been, you know, somebody like Charles Darwin or John Scopes, if you want to go forward a little bit in time, or if you want to go a lot forward in time, maybe somebody like Dawkins, trying to explain the theory of evolution to a creationist. And this is the conversation that I picture in my head. The creationist says, all right, so even though for centuries people have agreed and accepted the book of Genesis as the story behind how human beings came to be, you are claiming that that is wrong. And the person arguing from the evolution position would say, yes, I am definitely saying that that is not accurate. The creationist responds, okay then, answer me this one question. If you're saying that what we believe is wrong, then who made us? The person arguing for evolution is just dumbfounded by this question. And they're kind of confused about, are they asking me, do they realize that the question that they're asking is completely nugatory? Do they know that that's a question that can't be answered? Do they not have enough information to know that? Or do they have enough information to ask me a question that they know I can't answer so they don't have to look at their own comfortable beliefs with some new skepticism? What are they doing here? But you play along. As the person arguing for evolution, you play along. And you say, well, you know, maybe you sound, you try to be patient, maybe you sound a little bit arrogant, like kind of a know-it-all, kind of self-righteous. And you say, well, geez, it's just not that simple. You see, billions and billions of years ago, there were these single-celled life forms. Most of this was happening in the ocean. And then we had these, you know, temperature changes. And right there, you get cut off by the creationist. And they say, wait a minute. Stop right there. Stop right there. This is what you always do. I ask you a simple question. Who made us? And you launch into this evasive speech that doesn't even come close to answering the very simple question that I asked. The question was, who made us? You can't answer it, so you fail. And I'm right, and you're dumb. Praise the Lord. Now, you have to kind of make a decision here. Does this person just have so little information about, you know, the reality, so little information about science that they think this is a valid question? Or are they maybe even subconsciously trying to set a trap to make it look like you can't provide an answer to the question? Now, at this point, you decide for some reason to persist, to keep arguing with the creationist, and a couple hours go by, maybe like a week. And at this point, the creationist has to admit that they cannot build any kind of rational counter-argument against any of the scientific evidence that you are bringing forward. They have a 2,000-year-old children's book, and you just have reams and reams of evidence, and it's pretty much the discussion is over. So here they are. They have this opportunity to admit, well, okay, maybe this is something that I should take a closer look at. But they don't. You know what they do? They say, fine, you can believe whatever you want, but you're going to go to hell. And they walk away. Have you ever had a conversation that felt like that? I sure have. And it doesn't matter what the topic was. It could have been economics, education, foreign policy, whatever. In the end, you always have that resort to fear. But there's another problem that happened before that. That type of thinking, that, okay, then, who made us question, is very indicative of a real authority and hierarchy-oriented mindset. That's a difficult trap to break out of. There is no answer to the question, who made us? There is no central plan for any of these other discussions that we're having, but if you cannot craft the central plan, you lose. We've been over all that before. Now listen, it would be so simple, it would make things so easy to understand if I could sum up all of my failures to persuade other people and to communicate these ideas effectively to other people, if I could sum that all up as some kind of a problem that they had. But I don't think it's that simple. I think for years I had a communication strategy that was offensive and threatening and maybe somewhat antagonistic and arrogant. And people learned the Minesweeper game. They learned where the mines were and they learned how to play. So even though I'm taking an entirely different tact on Christmas with people, I'm still running into the same kind of evasions because of the things that I've done in the past, especially the moralizing. And that's really frustrating because moral arguments worked so well for the worst people in the world for thousands of years. It would be nice if that could be a tool in our toolbox. But when people have to come eye to eye with this, this aggression that they support, that they make possible, shit, it's just too much for some of them. And the channels of communication close off. People don't like to be told that they're supporting aggression against their own children that they claim to love and care so much about. That's tough. So even though this discussion went better than a lot of the discussions and quasi debates that I've had in the past, there still were a lot of obstacles. But we were able to talk about needs and means to an end. And one of the biggest obstacles when you're discussing these ideas with people over 50 or 60, with the older generation, in addition to all those emotional obstacles of you've been deceived your entire life, all of this money that you willingly give up every year goes to incarcerate nonviolent people, it goes to help some of the most selfish and dangerous, selfish in a bad way, destructive kind of selfish people in society, it goes to murder innocent people in other countries. The other obstacle, just when it comes to needs, is that people have a need for safety and security and stability and predictability that is not being met by the discussion or the idea of a voluntary society. When these people turn 65, which for some of them is like right around the corner, they know where their healthcare is coming from. They know where their income, or maybe just their supplemental income, is coming from. They need to pretend that all of this stuff is sustainable, that it does mean security. They are not going to respond to the idea that it's actually the opposite, that, oh, black is actually white. How do you feel about that? Can you just integrate that into your thinking very quickly and seamlessly? Of course not. So, for a long time in these conversations, when I talk about my arrogance and antagonism, I was trying to set these traps. And people will fall right into them. People will defend the Nazis. They'll say it's okay to throw babies off a cliff. And that's frustrating for them. And they don't want to have these kind of conversations anymore, because they're just getting bullied. You know, if your goal with a conversation is to set a bunch of traps or to put people in a bunch of traps to show them who's boss, It's basically like being your own state, because that's what the state does, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So this new approach was refreshing, but it also revealed to me some of the damage that I've done in the past and how I've probably sabotaged future opportunities to connect with some of these people due to past strategies. I tried these conversations with family, with friends, with coworkers, variety of different age groups. Some people were very easy to convince. Some people just were very, very clear that no matter what I said, it was an impossible task for me to change their mind about anything. But after years of doing this, this is my scorecard. Not one person, not ever, could ever build any kind of argument against the non-aggression principle. No one ever said that it's okay to initiate force against innocent people. When we strip it down to just the principle, no one could argue with that. Nobody questioned the idea of self-ownership versus slavery or partial enslavement. And nobody, not one person, ever said that they advocate the use of force against me to see their collective political will move forward. They might have, you know, felt that way, but they never said it. So right there, we have, you know, the foundation of this pyramid, of this idea that leads to that conclusion of the voluntary society. The foundation is built. So now when I would try to add the next layer, the next level, the next set of bricks, it would collapse. And I would even reassure them this is a gradual process. It's probably multi-generational. It really starts with changing the way that children are raised and children are treated and children are educated. And I just want to start like moving these ideas forward in my lifetime, that that's important to me. You are going to die still collecting your Social Security check, still eligible and on your Medicare. You don't have to worry about this. This is not a political campaign speech. I am not part of a pack. This is not an agenda. These are ideas that are going to take time. I just want to start putting them forward now. I wish they wouldn't be met with so much hostility. But as I tried to work my way up the pyramid to this conclusion, I just was fought with so much resistance, so many catastrophic what-if scenarios that could happen in this stateless society. And it really came down to, in this last conversation, me realizing that people are terrified of this, right? People are trapped as dependents. They've been trained to be this way their entire lives, right? We start as dependents. We start as deferring to authority. And because of the systems that the state has set up, we end that way as well. This is especially true for the group of people who have the least to lose and historically have been the most likely to mount some kind of rebellion or insurrection against the powers that be, the poor.
I get up in the morning, I set my alarm clock. I go over to Dennis and wake him up. Tell him, you know, he knows, pop it in his mouth, drink, take a couple of sips, and he goes right back to sleep for about an hour.
Geneva Fielding resisted putting her sons on drugs despite their behavioral, emotional, and learning troubles. That included Dennis, her youngest, who doctors had diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. Fielding, who became a mother at 16, never liked how common it was to see children, particularly boys, on behavioral medications.
You know, I see some kids that look, you know, zombie-ish like.
Yet through word of mouth in her neighborhood, she heard that these drugs can indirectly lead to $700 a month. A child would have to qualify for a federal disability program called Supplemental Security Income, or SSI for short.
I've always heard about SSI, even as a little girl. It's like welfare. It's the way to get money. It's the way to survive.
Raising three energetic boys on her own, Fielding has always needed the extra money.
Each of my kids has a binder. I keep all their important stuff in here.
She had put in SSI applications for her two older sons, who were not on medications, but they were rejected.
Get proof of this and proof of that.
Only last year, when teachers strongly recommended she try drugs for Dennis, was she willing to try.
I didn't want to hold Dennis back if this was going to help him.
At school, teachers have noticed an improvement in Dennis's behavior since he's started taking the drugs.
It's like, well, I want to do something, it just stops me from doing it. You just change.
Dennis was quickly approved for SSI benefits, worth thousands of dollars a year.
From Boston.com, the website for the Boston Globe, The Other Welfare, A Legacy of Unintended Side Effects, by Patricia Wen, Globe staff, December 12, 2010. Geneva Fielding, a single mother since age 16, has struggled to raise her three energetic boys in the housing projects of Roxbury. Nothing has come easily, least of all money. Even so, she resisted some years back when neighbors told her about a federal program called SSI that could pay her thousands of dollars a year. The benefit was a lot like welfare, better in many ways, but it came with a catch. To qualify, a child had to be disabled, and the disability was mental or behavioral, something like ADHD, and the child pretty much had to be taking psychotropic drugs. Fielding never liked the sound of that. She had long believed too many children take such medications, and she avoided them, even as clinicians were putting names to her boys' troubles: oppositional defiant disorder, depression, ADHD. But then, as bills mounted, friends nudged her about SSI, telling her to go try. Eventually she did, putting in applications for her two older sons. Neither was on medications. Both were rejected. Then, last year, school officials persuaded her to let her 10-year-old son try a drug for his impulsiveness. Within weeks, his SSI application was approved. To get the check, Fielding 34 has concluded with regret, you've got to medicate the child. There's nothing illegal about what Fielding did, and a lot that is perhaps understandable for a mother in her plight. But her worries and her experience capture, in one case, how this little scrutinized $10 billion federal disability program has gone seriously astray, becoming an alternative welfare system with troubling built-in incentives that risk harm to children. A Globe investigation has found that this Supplemental Security Income Program, that's SSI, created by Congress primarily to aid indigent children with severe physical disabilities such as cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and blindness, now largely serves children with relatively common mental, learning, and behavioral disorders such as ADHD. It has also created for many needy parents a financial motive to seek prescriptions for powerful drugs for their children. And once a family gets on SSI, it can be very hard to let go. The attraction of up to $700 a month in payments and the near automatic Medicaid coverage that comes with SSI approval leads some families to count on a child's remaining classified as disabled, even as his or her condition may be improving. It also leads to many teenage beneficiaries to avoid steps, like taking a job, that might jeopardize the disability check. The latest federal statistics obtained by the Globe through a public records request show a stunning rise over the past two decades in the number of children who qualify for SSI because of a variety of mental disabilities. Of the 1.2 million low-income children nationwide who received SSI checks last year, 53%, or 640,000, qualified because of mental, learning, or behavioral issues, up from 8% in 1990. It's up almost 50%, 45% in 20 years. That has increased by a factor of almost 7 in the last 20 years. By significant margins, the top two disorders are attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and delayed speech in young children, followed by autism spectrum disorders, bipolar illness, depression, and learning problems, according to the Social Security Administration, which runs this program, and the $55 billion SSI system for adults.
In New England, the numbers are even higher. 63% of children qualify for SSI based on such mental disabilities. That is the highest percentage of any region in the country. And here and across the nation, the SSI trend line is up, with children under 5 the fastest growing group. Once diagnosed, these children often bring in close to half their family's income. This has become the new welfare, said MIT economics professor David Autor. This is a very valuable resource to families, but you're providing incentives for them to produce a diagnosis for their children to be part of this program, and there's also incentives to medicate them. This is a substantial public policy problem. This transformation of the children's SSI program is viewed as a victory by many disability and mental health advocates who have long pressed for serious cases of depression and learning disorders to be recognized alongside cerebral palsy and Down syndrome as major disabilities. The program's expansion has also undoubtedly helped many new families cope with the exhausting needs of deeply troubled children. A few years ago, we never saw a bipolar diagnosis in a child. Now we do, said David Rust, a top Social Security official who defended the agency's handling of the SSI Children's Program in an interview with The Globe. The world is changing in terms of who we serve and the kinds of conditions we see. And Mr. Rust offers no explanation for that. But The Globe Review found the changing nature of the SSI program has had some disturbing side effects. Many cash-strapped parents have come to believe that if only they can muster the necessary array of medical records, their children have a good shot at this benefit, even if it means carrying the stigma of the word disabled. And while some parents see their children's behavior improve from psychotropic drugs, as has been the case so far with Fielding's youngest boy, they bristle at the outsized role that these medications seem to play in securing SSI approval. For many, the motivation to apply comes down to economics. SSI payments can be a lifeline in a bad economy, and they beat welfare checks in almost every way. For a Massachusetts parent with 2 children, welfare pays a maximum of about $600 a month. If one of those 2 children is approved for the SSI program, the total government benefit can be twice as much. Everyone's poor. Everyone's got issues, Fielding said as she sat in her family's apartment near Madison Park. People are going to try to get a check. New heading, learning the system. At the beginning of every month, postal carriers drop more than 21,000 SSI checks on behalf of children into mailboxes across Massachusetts, mostly in distressed areas of Springfield, Boston, Holyoke, Lawrence, and New Bedford. Only youngsters living around the poverty level are financially eligible, and many of their parents, out of work and maxed out on welfare benefits, have grown resigned to homeless shelters and food pantries. The children on SSI represent a cross-section of the poor. Federal data show that roughly half identified as white, half as black, some 16% self-identified as Hispanic. 2 out of every 3 recipients are boys, in part because ADHD diagnoses skew heavily male. And ADHD is the top diagnosis, constituting 31% of all children on SSI for behavioral learning or mental disorders. As the Globe investigated the surge in SSI cases, mostly by visiting housing projects, Social Security offices, and downtown districts, many parents were reluctant to talk, fearful of losing this coveted benefit. Still, some 2 dozen families agreed to be interviewed, in part to vent their frustration at what they perceived to be the government's arbitrary approval process in mental disability cases. Some wanted only their first names to be used as they described their persistent efforts to figure out what Social Security wanted and their growing conviction that medication for the child was a critical step. Waiting on the bench in a rundown commercial strip of Lawrence, Yesenia was among the frustrated. The 28-year-old woman said late last summer that she will be trying for the 3rd time to obtain SSI payments for her 7-year-old son based on his ADHD symptoms, impulsivity, and inattention. Yesenia said she is convinced that her son's first 2 applications were rejected because she has nothing to list in the section labeled medications. But in recent months, she has convinced the boy's doctor to write a prescription. Her son is now taking a stimulant, often used for ADHD. If your child doesn't have medications, the SSI office thinks he doesn't have any big problem, she said. Yesenia and her extended family have long experience with the SSI program. As a child, she said, she qualified for SSI because of learning disabilities, and after her 18th birthday, she re-qualified as an adult on the same basis. Her older sister, diagnosed with bipolar disorder, has been receiving SSI benefits since childhood. Yesenia said she has other reasons to be optimistic that her son's new application will be approved. Since he was denied all the time, the therapist said she'd give him another diagnosis, and that's when she said he's got depression, said the mother, who has yet to submit the new application. She's also recommending another drug. Yesenia and others interviewed insisted that they do only what is best for their children's health and would never medicate purely to boost their SSI application. But some parents said they know of others who exaggerate their children's symptoms so that clinicians prescribe medications or add additional psychiatric diagnoses. A lot of people do it, says Makesha, a Jamaica Plain mother whose child is on SSI for ADHD. A lot of people don't have income coming in. A special education teacher at Holyoke High School with 2 decades of experience said it is clear to her that indigent parents learn through word of mouth the strategic ins and outs of the SSI system. The teacher, who asked not to be named because she is not authorized to speak about student records, said she has seen hundreds of teenagers on SSI for mental disabilities. I don't know anyone who isn't on drugs, she said. She also said she is frequently asked by parents to complete SSI paperwork about a child's academic level in hopes that it will confirm a diagnosis for some type of mental disorder. New heading, a horrifying case, is if you didn't see that coming. The incentives built into the SSI program and their potential hazards came into starkest relief in the case of a South Shore couple, Carolyn and Michael Riley. Their story was horrifying and far from typical, but also telling about how a child's mental health diagnosis can be abused in the name of money. Each of their 3 children was, according to medical records, diagnosed with ADHD and bipolar disorder and prescribed 3 powerful drugs. The parents made sure to highlight the youngsters' prescription data in their SSI applications. If not for medication, my son would not be able to sleep more than 3 hours in a 24-hour period, Michael Riley wrote. The parents obtained SSI benefits for the oldest 2 children and for themselves through the SSI program for adults. They were applying for benefits for 4-year-old Rebecca when the child turned gravely ill sometime after midnight on December 13, 2006. Rebecca had been sick with a respiratory infection, but the Rileys did not take her to a doctor. Instead, they fed her excessive amounts of clonidine, a sedating medication often prescribed for ADHD, to get her to sleep. She ultimately died of a drug overdose, and jurors this year convicted her parents of killing Rebecca with their reckless care. Records made public during the murder trial show the parents' casual approach to medication over the years and how their calculated pursuit of SSI checks and psychiatric pills caused them to exaggerate their children's behaviors to clinicians, including a Tufts Medical Center psychiatrist. Until the day Rebecca died, the family depended largely on SSI checks totaling roughly $30,000 a year, plus Medicaid, of course. As extreme as their case proved to be, the way this family sustained itself financially is far from rare. As more families are cut off from the nation's welfare benefits, millions of indigent parents have turned to SSI. Said Williams College economist Lucy Schmidt, it's become the de facto backup safety net. Top officials in the Social Security Administration, in an interview this fall at the agency's headquarters just outside Baltimore, insisted that they do their best to implement the congressional mandates for the SSI Children's Program, which requires sensitivity to a wide range of physical and mental disabilities, while approving only those children with severe impairments. Art Spencer, Associate Commissioner in the agency's Office of Disability Programs, said he was disturbed to hear that the Globe's review found that many indigent families are convinced that psychotropic drugs are critical to obtaining SSI benefits. Medication helps confirm a diagnosis, but most of the decision is going to be based on the child's function, said Spencer, whose agency's primary job is overseeing the nation's $800 billion program for retirees and other workers' benefits. Rust, Deputy Commissioner in the Office of Retirement and Disability Policy, said each child's case is carefully reviewed by a disability examiner as well as an in-house pediatrician. He said that the agency does not currently track how many children on SSI are prescribed psychotropic medications, but that a new computerized record-keeping system may give them the ability to do so. Rust emphasized that, ultimately, awarding benefits rests largely on what the child's doctors and clinicians say about the child's impairment, and that the agency needs to trust that information. He said on occasion, disability officials have spotted clusters of SSI families with the same doctors and with strikingly similar diagnosis and treatments, and referred those for possible fraud prosecution. But mostly, he said, we work off the medical evidence we get. Rust, a former high school teacher, acknowledged, however, that the risk of long-term SSI enrollment may exact a psychic toll. One of my concerns about the program is that by designating a child as being disabled, it creates a certain mindset with the child, with the family, with the schools. You're disabled. You are unable to do certain things, he said. I really do worry in the program's attempt to help children, and that's what we're trying to do. We can create a certain psychology of disability that's hard to break. New heading, a subjective scale. It is easy to see why indigent families are confused by eligibility rules and looking for a shortcut to SSI approval. On paper, the eligibility requirements are daunting. According to the most recent Social Security rules passed in 1996, a child can be approved for mental disability benefits only if he or she has a, quote, medically determinable impairment that results in marked and severe functional limitations, unquote. The impairment should be one that persists for at least a year or may result in death. Huh. In some instances, a specific diagnosis for a severe condition, schizophrenia, for example, is a virtual and uncontroversial guarantee of benefits. But most diagnoses are not of that severity, and SSI approval hinges on the highly subjective determination of whether the child's condition or cluster of conditions amounts to a severe impairment. Officials wade through pile of medical, clinical, pharmacy, and school records, some haphazardly or partially completed, to determine how a child functions in six designated domains, such as how well he or she communicates, or gets along with peers, or can take care of his own basic needs. One marked impairment is not enough for SSI approval, but a severe impairment in one domain, or alternatively, marked impairments in two domains, is. Officials may also rely on standardized neuropsychological and other tests or hire independent medical experts to evaluate the child. Nevertheless, in many cases, diagnoses are based largely on a parent's account, and disability evaluators never meet the child face-to-face. Jennifer Urquhart, the co-author of the Harvard University Press book Medicating Children about the rise of ADHD diagnoses nationwide, said, "It is easy to see how psychotropic drugs have turned into a potential marker of a mental disorder's severity. If the doctor says it's serious, he's giving a prescription," says Urquhart, a political science professor at the University of Richmond. She said it is unclear whether the SSI approval process is a factor behind federal data showing that indigent children are diagnosed and prescribed psychiatric drugs at a higher rate than more well-off children. A 2008 study found, for example, that 12% of children on Medicaid were diagnosed with ADHD compared with 8% of children on private insurance. Other national studies using Medicaid data have found that poor children with behavioral and mental diagnoses are also medicated with ADHD drugs and antipsychotic medications at higher rates. Urquhart said researchers have cited many explanations for this difference, including the possibility that doctors are more inclined to medicate poor children or that higher rates of mental disorders exist among the destitute. She said that among the nexus of reasons is that indigent families may be more open to psychotropic drugs if they believe a prescription will help a child's SSI application. Patricia Thompson, a Fall River mother of two, cited another reason why poor families may be quicker to medicate their children for behavioral problems. They don't have the time for bus or subway rides to talk therapy sessions, and they know that counseling sessions are unlikely to impress a disability examiner. Thompson, 28, said her job in the healthcare industry made her realize the importance of trying behavioral therapy. She took her sons to such sessions before agreeing reluctantly last year to let her sons start a prescription of an ADHD medication. She has since put in SSI applications for both boys, ages 7 and 10, whose diagnoses include depression, anxiety, and learning disorders. But many indigent parents, she said, do not realize that there are alternatives to drugs or don't have the time to pursue them. It's easier to medicate, said Thompson, recounting what she hears from other parents. Thompson is still waiting to hear how SSI rules on her oldest boy's application. Her 7-year-old boy was denied, she said, adding that she was not given a reason. She said that the denial may indicate that the drugs are not a decisive factor, but she said that, based on her knowledge of other cases, an application with no mention of drugs has little to no chance of success. Even if both sons' applications are denied, she said, she is grateful that her job gives her enough income to provide the basics. But she can understand why others, more impoverished, seek SSI approval. Money determines everything, she said. It determines how much you eat, what you eat, and how you treat your kids. New heading, landmark ruling. The Federal Disability Program for Poor Children was born 4 decades ago, shortly after Congress rejected President Nixon's groundbreaking 1969 proposal for a guaranteed minimum income for the poor. Instead, as a compromise of sorts, federal lawmakers approved the Supplemental Security Income Program for the elderly, as well as for blind and disabled adults. Some early drafts of the proposal made no mention of children, but at the 11th hour, and virtually as a footnote, lawmakers in 1972 designated disabled children eligible for SSI payments. The idea was that the benefit would help replace wages lost by indigent parents as they took time out to care for children with severe physical and congenital disabilities, such as cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, and deafness, or those with life-threatening illnesses such as cancer. The money was also seen as a way to help families with extra expenses, such as wheelchairs or taxi rides to hospitals. It remained for many years a relatively small, highly restrictive program. As late as 1990, it served fewer than 300,000 children, and only 8% qualified based on behavioral or mental disorders. Then, after a landmark legal ruling, the ground began to shift. The case grew out of a campaign in the early 1980s under President Reagan to reduce SSI rolls. Social Security officials, responding to the new mandate, cut off Brian Zebley, a boy who had been receiving benefits since he was a toddler, ruling that he was no longer disabled despite a variety of physical and intellectual disabilities. His family's lawyer challenged the fairness of the eligibility rules, arguing that they were too adult-oriented and rigid, and in 1990, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. Social Security authorities then rushed to implement new, looser rules and also widen eligibility for children's behavioral and learning disorders. A subsequent spike in mental disability cases led to a national uproar. Media accounts describe parents coaching their children to misbehave or flunk tests. Some of those who desired change wanted ADHD cut from the list of allowed SSI diagnoses, arguing that the condition was not typically severe and its inclusion was leaving the system vulnerable to an explosion of claims. But they were drowned out by advocates for the disabled. Meanwhile, some federal authorities raised concerns about the program's potential to harm children. Here, the moral hazard is that the family may become dependent on SSI, and in order to continue to receive payments, decline to seek treatment aggressively or fail to encourage a child to do his or her best to overcome a disability, said Jim Slattery, a former congressman and chairman of the National Commission on Child Disability, during a 1995 hearing. By the mid-1990s, federal lawmakers were cracking down. Congress passed tougher standards for SSI mental disability disorders, saying a child now had to exhibit a medically determinable disability with marked and severe limitations. These changes were included as part of sweeping 1996 welfare reforms. The children's SSI disability rolls instantly shrunk, but the decline would be short-lived. Families and clinicians began to adjust to the new rules, which emphasize extensive medical records for any claimed disability. From 1997 to 2007, the number of children who qualified under behavioral, mental, and learning disorders more than tripled, from 180,000 to 562,000. By last year, more than 639,000 children were on SSI, 53% of all cases. The abrupt climb in cases is a sign, some researchers say, that the SSI program has veered far from its original purpose. Dr. James Perrin, a Massachusetts General Hospital pediatrician who has served on federal panels evaluating the SSI program. Oh, good tip for reporters. If you're going to say something like some experts say or some researchers say or some people say, do what the Boston Globe did here and actually give some examples after you say that. Let me start that paragraph again. Dr. James Perrin, a Massachusetts General Hospital pediatrician who has served on federal panels evaluating the SSI program, defended the program, saying it cares for many of the most vulnerable youngsters. One of the SSI's main benefits, he said, is providing a near-automatic Medicaid coverage for disabled children. But he said some aspects of the program may need to be reconsidered, including the no-strings-attached cash benefit. Families with children with disabilities have real needs for additional income, but perhaps that money should be linked to meeting the specific needs of the child's disability and, where possible, to supporting that child's transition to productive adult life. New heading, driven by the dollar. The pressure on medical professionals to help families make the case for SSI approval can be considerable. One nurse practitioner in a large urban clinic who asked to be unnamed because she is not authorized to speak about her patients said she recently faced the wrath of a parent whose 4-year-old child's SSI benefits, granted at birth due to prematurity, were cut off because the child was much better now. The nurse said she had candidly filled out the SSI form about the child, saying that the boy had caught up with his peers and only had minimal defects. The mother was livid, shouting at her, "Don't you think this child's disabled?" "They got angry with us," the nurse practitioner said. One diagnosis she believes is seriously overused is the whole vague developmental delay category for young children, often preschoolers who are behaving badly at home or in daycare for undetermined reasons. She said clinicians often attribute such behavior to developmental delay, especially if they are sympathetic to that family's need for SSI payments. "It's all driven by the dollar," she said. Many doctors, therapists, and Social Security workers say they are well aware of the impact of SSI benefits can have on indigent families. Indeed, some clinicians said they often feel pressure to upgrade a diagnosis or tailor the SSI paperwork to increase the odds of approval. Some say that they go that extra mile because they believe that furthering the financial stability of needy families is essential in helping a troubled child. Some psychiatrists do feel these people are entitled to benefits, said Judy Rolfe, a pediatric psychiatric nurse in Boston for more than 30 years. You know these people are poor. Also, pushing hard for SSI approvals is the growing number of for-profit firms that specialize in helping poor families tap into SSI benefits. These companies, which call themselves eligibility service providers, are hired by hospitals which stand to lose money when caring for uninsured patients. If these firms successfully obtain SSI benefits for an uninsured child, the youngster's medical bills are paid by Medicaid. The reimbursement rates are even higher if the child is deemed disabled. Health insurance companies, which administer Medicaid plans, also sometimes hire these firms for similar financial reasons. State welfare department officials also often urge poor families to apply for SSI benefits on behalf of their children. There, too, money is the motivation. An indigent child cannot be on both welfare and SSI at the same time, so states save money if a child goes on SSI, which is entirely paid for by federal funds. The cost of traditional welfare is covered by state and federal money. Such help with the SSI application can be critical for parents, many of whom are at a loss to complete the complex paperwork. Giselle Cabrera, a family services coordinator at the Head Start Preschool in Holyoke, who helps families with SSI applications, sees firsthand how parents struggle to complete certain SSI forms and wonder how candid to be about children's symptoms. "They are often desperate," she said, "and often medication is what they believe will help their child's case. It's very frustrating for parents," she said. Last heading. It's all about surviving. Sitting in her apartment near Madison Park, Geneva Fielding is surrounded by stacks of well-organized SSI files for her 3 sons. She continues to be torn about medicating her youngest. Tucked among her thick files is a favorite article titled, "What If Einstein Had Been on Ritalin?" She acknowledges that her youngest boy is focusing more on his schoolwork and the doctors say his dosages of Concerta are safe. But still, she says, she wants to stop these drugs as soon as possible. She says she does not worry if her benefits in the future are cut. God's been good to me. If they cut me off, I'll be all right, says Fielding, who is active in parent and neighborhood groups. As she folds laundry in her three-bedroom apartment, she says she believes her middle child, the 14-year-old, has the greatest mental disabilities. He has been diagnosed with dyslexia, and he struggles with reading. He also has asthma and emotional issues. She worries that he will wind up illiterate, like his father. His SSI application has been rejected, but she is appealing. Fielding says the SSI checks have helped get her through difficult economic times, but she has mixed feelings about the role they play among poor families. She says she decided to speak to the Globe to highlight the worrisome incentive to prescribe children drugs. Sometimes I don't know why we get a check for this, she said, referring to her youngest son's case. But if someone says you have ADHD and you're depressed and you can get a check, they're going to try to get a check. The poor people will take that every time. It's all about surviving. The end.
Fielding finds herself of two minds about SSI. She criticizes the program for letting drugs play a dominant role in approvals, but she is also grateful for the extra income.
Honestly, if it's being offered, people are going to take it. That's just a no-brainer. Who says no thank you to extra money? Not me.
A Boston Globe investigation has found that Dennis is part of a growing trend within the SSI program. Originally created by Congress to aid indigent children with severe physical disabilities, like cerebral palsy or blindness, today, more than half of all SSI recipients are indigent children with relatively common behavioral or mental problems, like ADHD.
Today, many of these people living in poverty find themselves in such a trap, in such an impossible situation, that they're actually making decisions that might jeopardize the well-being of their children in order to maintain a feeling of safety or security that they feel only the government can provide for them. And when we look at this story of Miss Fielding, I mean, God, that's tragic. You know, like, putting this kid on these drugs. We talked about how that whole scheme works, you know, with the lobbying and all of this Medicaid and Social Security money just swashing around and nobody really paying attention to it. Of course those kinds of people are going to grab it. Of course they are. And even though this story that we read today is especially tragic, this is not a problem of the poor. You know, when you look at it in a wider sense, this is my parents. This is probably your parents. This is a trick that a lot of people who are not in poverty are playing on themselves every day. At the beginning of the show today, I was talking about my own tiny little successes and, you know, for the most part, large-scale failures, trying to convince people close to me that there are ways to solve complex social problems, the education of children, healthcare, without institutionalized violence. And I think that that's a worthy goal, and I think it's worth talking about, and I think it's worth injecting those ideas into every political conversation that they want to have if I'm sitting right there. Or so I thought in the past. Now, part of what I really thought was motivating me was the story that I used to tell myself. They would have these conversations, and they would sit around on both sides of the political spectrum and talk about things that they wanted the government to do or defend the things that the government was already doing. So for the Democrats, of course, it would be like government takeover of healthcare. And for the Republicans, it would be modest, small government projects like building a 1,500-mile-long border fence and global domination through the military. I would think about the costs. And of course, I would always, I also understood how all of these government projects are funded through debt, transferring the costs to future generations. I mean, I guess they say, these people can't
talk yet, or they don't even exist yet, so we'll just send them the bill, and that'll be perfect. They won't complain at all. During these conversations, I would find myself in the middle of three generations of my family. You know, my brothers have these kids that are like babies. And I'd hear these people talk, and just what I saw is just this such reckless myopia about economics and defense and healthcare. And I would look at these children and I would say, they're going to pay for this. And it was so sad to just, you know, knowing the momentum of the state that they were going to wind up getting preyed upon and robbed. But what's worse, what was even more upsetting is that the older generation, the people who do have some power and some ability to defend themselves, the people who do have a voice or the ability to use their voice to form complete sentences, would only use that voice to defend and rationalize the behavior of the parasites and the predators. And I would say, I have to intercede. I have to say something. Of course, that wasn't my real motivation, but that's a topic for another time. People, poor or not, for some reason, seem so willing to jeopardize, if not sacrifice, the security and prosperity of the future to avoid facing the reality of the present, which they believe brings some kind of security and prosperity. Is that like, is it getting clear to them that that's not the case yet? But they've been given every incentive to do just that for their entire lives. In the last half century, I think those in power have realized that if their day-to-day operations require them to put guns in the faces of their subjects, that kind of system does not have longevity. That kind of system will implode in no time. I mean, Nazi Germany came and went in two decades. Of course, there was a significant multi-generational precursor, but again, that's a topic for another time. So, as fascism collapsed, as communism collapsed, people in power seemed to realize that you can't get where you want, and you can't have something sustainable if you have to point guns on a daily basis. Keep the gun loaded, keep it in the holster, you might need it. But first, instead of the pointing of guns, try the dangling of resources. If people don't respond to that, then you can point the guns. Everybody got sucked into these traps. Into the final deal of statism. Just shut up and we'll give you stuff. And if you don't like that deal, if you don't accept that deal, we will hurt you. Boy, when it comes to accepting that, we've all had a lifetime of practice and preparation. What I believe, through my career, through doing this show, through talking with other people in the liberty movement, in the field of education, talking especially with adolescents, I've realized that there is a golden window of time, we'll call it, where people are especially reachable. We can't have these conversations, you know, about the state with five-year-olds, because what are they going to do? There's plenty of great stuff we can do with young kids, and I actually recently started working with a group of young kids, and man, it's awesome. I can't wait to tell you all about it. But again, topic for another time. We can't talk with people who are waiting to go on the dole, who have planned their entire future around being on the dole. But there is this age, these teenagers, maybe that's you, where you feel like an adult and you know all this stuff that you're being told and all of this day in and day out obedience training is bullshit. Well, for that group, there is something very attractive about the message of personal freedom, independence, and self-reliance. Of course, it's very important that we get to them before they accept their government student loans. That's where the window of opportunity certainly starts to close. And at least we have, you know, reason on our side. We have the ethical arguments on our side. We have, you know, a vision of a peaceful and prosperous future on our side. Because if we had the opposite goals, if we had the opposite agenda, and we still wanted to bring people in, we still wanted people to believe in us and trust us, then man, we would have to round up like billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars every year for bribery. And that would suck. And of course, that's not an original idea. Thanks.